All About Evelyn. It was October, and the year was 1901. Evelyn was day shy of her 21st birthday when she came out of Santa Maria Novella station for the first time and exclaimed, "Firenze, amore mio." The slow journey down from Lake Como had been made under an unrepentant, overcast sky, but here the sun was exceptionally bright. There was a strong smell of horse in the air. Omnibuses were waiting to transport tourists to hotels, and now the sound of bells. To look at her, she was dressed as any young modern Englishwoman of the time might be. She had shunned the corset in favour of a naturalistic silhouette. Long dark linen skirt complemented a tonally matching blouse. Her bonnet she carried. She had developed an ungainly gait due to a sudden growth spurt, but it would disappear by the time she was 24. On the plus side, though, she had the air of good breeding, mother's side, and bohemian outlook, father's side, to excuse whatever indiscretions might befall her throughout her life, of which there would be many. She looked back to check that the railway porter still had hold of her trunk. Hurrying after her were the newly married couple she'd met on the train. They were the Lugs, Hugh and Miranda, and it was their first time in Italy. Hugh was moving up the ranks in a private bank, and he was the shining example of a certain type of Englishman abroad who hated everything foreign. He was dragging along his new wife as if she was a wet blanket. Her pale face and large, haunted eyes were symptomatic of a lymphatic temperament unsuited to a European diet. They had been travelling for 10 days already, and tripe had been the last straw. Even the word propelled Miranda Lugg towards an open window. In her arms, she clutched a small portable medicine case, prepared and stocked with tabloid drugs by Messrs. Burroughs, Wellcome & Co., Holborn Viaduct, London. On her breath was the faint whiff of camphor and indigestion. A tram rattled past, and Evelyn turned to watch it. Children were squealing and hanging off the platform at the back.
"You couldn't have heard me, Miss Skinner," said Mr. Lugg. "Shall we travel to the Simi together?"
"Oh, let's," said Evelyn, and she handed a generous gratuity to the porter.
"Far too much," said Hugh Lugg,
and strode towards a bored cabman. In unconfident but charming Italian, she said, "We would like to go to the Pensione Simi, to Lungarno delle Grazie, if you please." They wound down tight streets that echoed with the cries of men selling wares. Handcarts were laden with sacks and baskets from windows were being lowered to hawkers. Wine, vegetables, fruit, live chickens. "Look, a chicken!" But Mrs. Lugg didn't want to look at a squawking chicken. She was huddled over her handkerchief and having quite a turn because of the smell. It was of both human civilization and lack of it. So different to Kent, thought Evelyn. The horse turned left, and suddenly the Arno and bridges came into sight. "Oh, my," said Evelyn, as they clattered alongside the green water. A young man on a bicycle rode next to them, weaving in and out, laughing.
"Make him go away," said Mrs. Lugg. "Shoo, shoo, niente, niente," said Mr. Lugg.
Having consigned to memory Baedeker's advice on how to deal with importunate beggars. Evelyn said, "He's not a beggar, Mr. Lugg."
"What is he then, Miss Skinner?"
Evelyn turned back towards the cyclist and smiled. "He's alive." When the cab eventually pulled up outside the Simi, the horse released a torrent of hot, fumy scat, which sent Mr. and Mrs. Lugg running towards the entrance of the building. Trunks were carried in next, and Evelyn could hear the impatient ring of the desk bell. She followed swiftly behind the luggage, eager to acquaint herself with what would be her home for the next 28 days. Evelyn veered off to the drawing room, where her sight was arrested by Empire mahogany furniture and an ugly chandelier. Queen Victoria was still on the wall, sandwiched between two stained Hogarthian prints. A couple of silent elderly women and a white-whiskered clergyman looked up from the Chesterfield without acknowledging her. It was a room of melancholy, she thought, more like a funeral parlour than an authentic Italian boarding house full of conversazioni that she had been expecting. The piano in the corner had acquired a thick layer of dust as insulation.
Evelyn got to the reception desk, just as the landlady bustled down the stairs. "Scusi, scusi," she said. "Me Henry Zed got stuck in the back of a chair." And a Cockney landlady at that. "Welcome, dearie," she said. Evelyn heard dreary and said, "Yes, it is a bit." Her bedroom was a lot more agreeable, a lot more Italian, come to think of it, than the rooms downstairs, and after running her hand across the exquisite bed cover, she went to the window and threw open the shutters. The late afternoon light journeyed across the red-tiled floor and rested warmly on her feet. Below, trams rattled along the Lungarno, and the river slapped against the stone walls. The cypress trees appeared black against the golden haze of the sky. "I have a view," she sighed. When Evelyn entered the drawing room later that evening, she was not surprised to find the drink du soir was sherry and not a quina vermouth or the bright red bitters associated with aperitivo time. The silent women whom she had noticed when she had first arrived were sitting side by side on the same sofa, tête-à-tête with the same clergyman. On closer inspection, Evelyn realized that the two women were twins, quite elderly, with an outlook of similar bewilderment. "They are the Brown sisters," said a stout middle-aged woman suddenly at her side. "Their wardrobe seldom veers away from their name, so you can't forget them. The one on the left is Bernadette, the other is Blythe. We may presume someone in their family had a sense of humour. The clergyman is Reverend Hindsight, take from that what you will. He is a Protestant. The man in heated discussion with the Russian is Mr. Collins. He will fight any cause. He is a socialist. And I am Miss Constance Everly. I noticed you when you first walked in, and I said to myself, this young woman may yet be our saviour. As you can see," and she turned to the room, "not the liveliest bunch ever encountered at the Simi. Death hovers above the chintz, Miss—" "Oh, Skinner. Evelyn Skinner." They shook hands. "You are welcome, Miss Skinner. So lovely to have you on board. And with that, the first rule of pensioni life, that of scrutinising a guest for a day or two before conversing, was swiftly abandoned. Suddenly the creeping waft of overcooked brassicas corralled everyone to dinner. "Massacre of the innocents," intoned Miss Everly, as she raised her arm aloft and directed the troop towards the battlefield next door. At the dining table, Evelyn could see that trenches had been invisibly drawn, and she was glad to find herself opposite Miss Everly and next to the socialist. The Reverend placed himself at the head of the table, of course, and Evelyn was grateful that whatever grace he said was said silently. The Brown sisters made a fuss of sitting opposite the Lugs, and the Lugs were simply happy to be at a table with only English people. Evelyn looked over at the other table and couldn't work out if the four still waiting for their soup were sleeping or dead. The Reverend did the honours with the wine, and after the soup had been cleared, Evelyn dabbed her mouth with the linen and answered the question at hand. "I have a view," she said, most emphatically. "I don't," said Mr. Collins. "I have the cortile." "I too have a view," said Miss Everly, "as befits my status." "Miss Everly is a poet," said Mr. Collins. "Are you really?" said Evelyn. "For my sins, which are countless." "Mr. Collins!" "According to your verse, that is, Miss Everly." "You've read me, Mr. Collins," said Miss Everly. "How could I not?" "Miss Skinner," said Miss Everly, "do me the honour of telling me what you saw when you looked out of your window for the first time. Be robust and adventurous. Hold nothing back." And Miss Everly closed her eyes, ready to receive the descriptive benediction. Her words. Mr. Collins leant in close to Evelyn and said, "She asks the same of everyone when they arrive. Make it good." Evelyn cleared her throat. She said, "I saw a lone rower carving across the Arno. The foothills were darkening, and the cypress trees around San Miniato were topped by a ghostly mist. Ochre walls appeared more golden as the sun softened. Lights appeared throughout the city and took their place on the surface of the river. The rower slipped through this spectacle of light. Water dripped off the blades of his oars, and momentarily I was in that drip, falling into the green twilight depths of history.
"You have silenced the room," said the Reverend. The elderly twins applauded. The lady poet laughed.
"She is smitten already. You have caught the fever of Firenze. Oh, my dear Miss Skinner, there is no turning back. You shall die with those lights in your eyes. Miss Skinner has turned looking into loving. The first rule of art, looking into loving. Oh, welcome, my dear, welcome."
Mr. Collins stood up and replenished the wine glasses. He said, "Reverend Hindsight, what delight awaits you the other side of the shutter, Vista or Cortile?"
"Cortile," said the Reverend, wishing to move away from this subject.
"Washing lines and dripping undergarments for us, isn't it, Reverend?" said Mr. Collins.
"Really, Mr. Collins," said the elderly twin sisters in unison.
"He does it on purpose," said Miss Everleigh. "He likes to shock."
"I like to reposition."
"Bravo word," said Miss Everleigh.
"And what on earth does that mean?" said the Reverend.
"It's a changing world," was all Mr. Collins said. Evelyn caught him looking over at the painting of Queen Victoria. "Out with the old," he mouthed to Evelyn, and raised his eyebrows.
"Mr. Collins is a philosopher," said Miss Everleigh.
"Soi-disant," said the Reverend to the newly married couple, who he planned to take under his large vestal wing.
"Humanist," said Mr. Collins.
"Humorist," said Miss Everleigh.
Evelyn looked back and forth, following the conversations and consigning to memory who said what and how they said it. English through and through they were, and they expressed an excess of bonhomie, like those without lifebelts on a sinking ship. She liked Miss Everleigh immensely, and she liked Mr. Collins too, as he reminded her of her father, when he was younger, of course. And yet, she was most intrigued by the maid waiting in the corner of the room, staring at her. She didn't know what it was that made her heart thump so furiously, and at first thought it might have been the soup.
"Miss Skinner, you're positively red," said Miss Everleigh indiscreetly. "Are you hot?"
"No, I..."
"It's the wine. Maybe a slight fever?
All the travelling?"
"No," said Miss Skinner. I'm decidedly happy, that's all. To meet you all. And to be here in this moment in time."
Reciprocal sentiments were scattered like sugar beads. And in the midst of it all, Reverend Hindsight made an ill-timed proclamation. He said, "I shall be delivering a sermon at St. Mark's English Church this Sunday, if anyone is interested."
"Anyone?"
he said again. Luckily, the stew was carried in by the maid at that moment, saving anyone from answering.
"Beef stew again," said Mr. Collins.
"We presume it's beef," said Miss Everleigh, "but I, for one, haven't seen the elderly concierge for a while."
"Miss Everleigh, really," said the Reverend.
"Once more, unto the breach, dear friends," said Mr. Collins, picking up his spoon. Or did he need his fork? A knife, perhaps. And he rallied the other guests by example. All except the new wife, who Evelyn had met on the train. The Cockney Signora had prepared for her a bespoke meal of boiled egg and crumpets. Something recognisable, and more importantly, binding. The next day, Evelyn slept in late and missed the breakfast prunes. Outside the simi, she was greeted by a medley of sun and cloud. The temperature, though, was still warm. She didn't rush off to join the Reverend and his band of merry men. Instead, she stood back and watched life pass. The jingle of bells as horse and carts rattled by with laundry sacks from hotels. The one leaving the simi had a young man balanced precariously on a mountainous pile. He waved. She waved.
"That's Matteo," said Mr. Collins, standing behind her.
Evelyn turned and smiled. How lovely that Mr. Collins knew the young man's name. But of course, he was a socialist. "And where are you off to today, Mr. Collins?"
"I'm going for a shave. You can't beat an Italian barber, Miss Skinner. See you at dinner."
And she watched him race after the laundry cart. She crossed the road and leant against the embankment. The river was low, and the Renaioli were on a break. From dusk till dawn, the men shoveled sediment from the riverbed into carts or waiting boats.
Four of them were sitting smoking now, hats tilted back, shirt sleeves rolled high. Miss Everly said the gravel had been caused by the erosion of stone buildings along the riverbank in times of flood, and would be used again in future construction. Nothing was ever wasted, she said. The Arno was like the Ganges, the source of life, both giver and taker, sewer and fishmonger. Miss Everly knew everything about the city. Midway along the Ponte Vecchio, Evelyn's eye was drawn to the dark mass of the Casentino Valley, partly enveloped by mist. It was a thick forest land of black trees and swine and myths and hidden hermits, and had once been home to an exiled Dante. From its highest peak at Monte Falterona, the origins of the Arno bubbled forth. Evelyn thought about the holy place of La Verna, the desolate mountain given to St. Francis of Assisi, where he had received his stigmata and the grace of God. There were things she didn't believe in, and things she did. Saints she believed in. She continued north to the Piazza del Duomo, and when she arrived, the sun burst out between dark clouds and bells tolled from Giotto's marble campanile. She held on to her bonnet and looked up at the cupola, that unfailing landmark, glimpsed perpetually throughout the city. Ever since she was six and had first opened the pages of her father's sketchbook, she... Suddenly, a small chestnut mare, head concealed in a large bag of oats, shat loudly. Two English ladies passing by at the time were unconscionably splashed. Their screams were piercing, and Evelyn's moment of homage ruined. Undeterred, she wandered the vicinity and came across a delightful second-hand bookshop and picked up a copy of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Casaguidi Windows. Miss Everly said she would take Evelyn to visit Casaguidi the following week. And just as Evelyn was handing over her money, she spotted a slim volume in burgundy cloth by one Constance Everly. Down the spine in faded gilt, its Italian title, Niente, Nothing. All roads really do lead to poetry. Evelyn settled outside at a cafe in the Piazza Vittorio Emanuele and couldn't decide which book to open first, so embraced the European pastime of watching people instead. Women, mostly, it has to be said. And the obvious comparisons issued forth. Better hair, better shape, better smile. But there was something else too, something to do with the maid who had trespassed continually on her day. It hadn't been an uncomfortable intrusion, and in truth, she couldn't wait for dinner. That night, the Reverend was complaining about having paid half a lira to see vast quantities of bad art in a palazzo he couldn't remember the name of. Baroque, he said, tutting loudly. The art of bad taste. The Reverend believes Florentine art stopped at the end of the 16th century, said Mr. Collins. What's that you're saying? Said the Reverend. You believe no good art came after the 16th century, said Mr. Collins, voice elevated. It had reached its zenith, that's all I'm saying. The city had changed. So, no Rubens, no Velasquez, no Artemisia, no listening, Mr. Collins. My father is the painter H.W. Skinner, said Evelyn. Oh, I knew it, said Miss Everly. I could see the likeness. I saw his recent show at the Royal Academy. I did too, said Mr. Collins. Would I know his work? Asked Reverend Hindsight. I doubt it, Reverend. Lots of nudes and not all pudica. He did landscapes too, said Evelyn. And nudes in landscape. What was that one? After Titian. He was heavily influenced by the post-impressionists, I read, said Mr. Lugg proudly. Yes, said Evelyn. Cézanne especially. I met him. Sleeping Venus, that's the one, said Miss Everly. Did you really? Asked Mrs. Lugg. And how was he? Asked Mr. Collins. Titian? Asked the Reverend, confused. Cézanne, clarified Mr. Collins. French, said Evelyn. And everyone said, ah, as if that was description enough. Evelyn sat back and thought, what a lively table we are. She looked at the other guests, and they were silent and still struggling with their soup. She wondered how they would cope should they have to chew.
When dinner came to its natural conclusion, the maid began to clear. She manoeuvred herself behind Evelyn, and Evelyn could feel the nudge of her body and the faint whiff of sweat as she bent over her shoulder. Evelyn couldn't take her eyes off her. And as the maid's hand moved to collect the furthest plates, a shaft of candlelight lit the dark hairs on her arm, and Evelyn felt a little light-headed. An empty glass was knocked over, and Evelyn instinctively reached for it, and so did the maid, and their hands touched briefly, and they looked at one another.
"Vi chiedi scusa," said the maid,
and she threw a surreptitious wink Evelyn's way. Evelyn tried to hide her smile, but failed.
"Share your thoughts, Miss Skinner," said the Reverend.
Said Evelyn, playing for time. "It's my birthday next week. Am I allowed to say that, or was it..."
"Indeed you are," said Miss Everly.
"I'm going to be 21," said Evelyn.
21.
"Maybe the Signora could rustle up a roast," said the Reverend.
"A roast?" said Evelyn. "I was hoping for something a little more authentic. Maybe a visit to a trattoria full of locals."
The rumble of a delicate home county's stomach voiced its protest. "I know the perfect place," said Mr. Collins. "On Tornabuoni. Open kitchen, charcoal stove stoked by hand, sparks flying everywhere." Mr. Lugg said he and his wife wouldn't be able to join her should the dubious charms of an illegible Italian menu prevail over the safety of English fare. "We must stay close to home on account of my wife's condition," he said. Evelyn said she understood. The phrase, however, went around the room as swiftly as a cholera outbreak, and Mrs. Lugg's condition was, of course, understood as pregnancy. In the days to come, the comments came quietly on the breath.
"How are you doing, Mrs. Lugg? A little sickness?"
"A little," said the unwitting new bride.
"But you must be so pleased."
This confused her.
"First time?"
"No, I had a little bout in Venice."
Later, lying in her room, Evelyn was left swooning and breathless by the events of the evening. The attraction she had to the maid, the attraction the maid had to her. Life was unfolding at an extraordinary pace. She could still hear voices in the drawing room below, a faint murmur and a burst of laughter. She knew that at some point in the evening, after she'd left the table, the conversation would have turned inevitably to her father's mistresses and the so-called arrangement in her parents' marriage. And sure enough, she heard footsteps on the landing, the word mistress, and monies on the mother's side. She rolled over and attempted sleep. The next day, rain. The smell of wood smoke crept under Evelyn's bedroom door as the first hearth fires were lit in the salon below. In a letter to her father, Evelyn wrote, "My dearest father, I was awoken by a very dramatic storm last night. Lightning splintered the sky, and by morning the Arno was a raging torrent. The sand diggers cannot work this morning, I fear. I shall miss them. My thoughts turn to the great flood of 1333. Evelyn put down her pencil. She had little to say on the great flood of 1333. She stood up from the desk. The sky was marbled violet grey, though the sun was trying to break through. She opened the window and stuck out her hand. The rain had ceased, and there wasn't a moment to lose. She put on her bonnet and hoisted up her skirt, full pelt down the stairs, straight into the arms of the maid. Linen broke their fall, and laughter their embarrassment. They were so close. It would have been rude not to kiss, but...
"Perdonatemi."
"No, it's me. I'm the one who's sorry."
"What's going on here?"
said the Cockney Signora, marching across the landing. "It was all my fault, Signora," said Evelyn. "I didn't look where I was going."
"Bit of decorum, dearie," said the Signora,
who moved swiftly over to the linen closet. The two young women were silent. They watched the Signora depart and shifted gracefully into her absence. They acknowledged their hand-holding with further pressure. They swapped names, Livia, Evelyn, and they said goodbye. Evelyn stopped by the door and looked back. She said goodbye again. She rushed out.
She felt light-headed and giddy, and the most intense happiness she had ever felt in her life. She turned towards the Uffizi, knowing she was on the threshold of the most thrilling adventure ever.
Miss Skinner?
It was Miss Everly.
Hello there, said Evelyn. You look positively radiant. The city is infusing us with all sorts of... Oh, my, said Evelyn, covering her nose.
Ah, yes, said Miss Everly. The smell of Florence, waste and deterioration. It's the Pozzi Neri, agitated by the rain. Vast containers of the stuff spilling beneath us. Suddenly its presence rises up. But one doesn't come to Italy for niceness. One comes for life, for passion. And where are you off to, Miss Skinner, this fine day?
To here, the Uffizi.
Oh, goodness,
so am I. Would you like company and a very enthusiastic guide?
I'd be delighted, said Evelyn. As they approached the entrance to the gallery, the corner of a damp loincloth was lifted by the breeze, alerting them to the presence of a half-naked living statue.
I really did think it was a statue, said Evelyn.
Who's it supposed to be? Whispered Evelyn.
Michelangelo.
How can you tell?
The pose. Rather fey. And also the tondo at his feet. A poor imitation of the Holy Family. I would have thought a tin cup more appropriate to collect coinage.
Shall I give him a lira, Miss Everly?
You will certainly not. Stick to the coppers, Miss Skinner. A couple of centesimi at most. It's not as if he's doing anything.
And they bustled past him into the building. At the bottom of the stairs, Miss Everly said, You'll see a lot of annunciations, Miss Skinner. Many adorations of the Magi. Depositions from the cross and, oh yes, let's not forget flagellations of Christ. And we'll see a lot of ecstasy today, and not all of it spiritual. But I can see you are a woman of the world.
I am, said Evelyn.
Good, said Miss Everly. And she held up her skirt and said, I hope you have good knees, Miss Skinner.
Oh, I do, said Evelyn, taking off her bonnet. They're my mother's, sturdy and Italian. Hers found every Saint's Day.
Marvellous.
Avanti, then. Let's proceed to climb.
There was little conversation until they reached the upper floor, where Miss Everly suggested they head straight to the tribuna. Along the corridor, they passed countless Apollos and Ceres and Tiberius and various other Roman antiquary, only for Miss Everly to point out a facial anomaly or expression. Full of indecision, that face. Couldn't order a bistecca, let alone an army. And when they came across Hercules slaying the centaur Nessus, Miss Everly said that the Giovanni da Bologna in the Loggia dei Lanzi was far, far superior.
Through here, said Miss Everly. Ah, Masaccio's Madonna and Child. Such fragility, such... Ooh, the Filippo Lippi, Madonna and Child again, but this time with two angels for variation. Botticelli was his pupil, Miss Skinner. Can you see the influence?
But it was a rhetorical question.
Come on, then, said Miss Everly. There's some lovely hair in the Botticelli room.
And to the Botticelli room they went. They stood back, scrutinizing a painting.
Well, she looks bored, said Evelyn. Must be hard being a Madonna.
Utterly thankless, said Miss Everly.
And yet, she is the prototype for all Italian women. Now, the pomegranate, Miss Skinner, is the symbol of eternal life? Resurrection?
Correct.
It is also the fruit of many legends.
And Miss Everly looked about and lowered her voice. She said,
Greek mythology says that the pomegranate grew out of the blood from Agdestes' wounded...
Evelyn leant in closer.
From his wounded what, Miss Everly?
Miss Everly looked about her again and said, Penis, Miss Skinner. Gasps from a nearby tour group.
Agdestes was a lustful young god, violent and rather unlikable, whose genitals were tied up by good old Bacchus. A peckish nymph came by, ate the fruit,
and became pregnant as a result. Ergo, symbol of fertility. And you won't get that from a Baedeker. This way, my dear. And she marched ahead. Not going too fast for you, am I?
Oh, not at all, said Evelyn.
Another annunciazione, said Miss Everleigh. Hello, Gabriel. Hello, Mary. Ah, and here we are. La Tribuna. Scusate, Americani, scusate. They do hog the space somewhat. The most important jewels of the Medici collection, Miss Skinner. A dome of wonder encrusted with thousands of precious shells, whispering of distant shores of trade and commerce. A marble floor, the red velvet cloak of walls. How many poems, how many declarations of love, how many promises to better one's soul has such a room elicited, where beauty and gratitude go together. This is how we become enriched, Miss Skinner. The confinement of the room sent them in opposite directions, and Evelyn felt glad to have a moment to herself. The sight of so much female flesh was having a very positive effect on her body, although a dizzying one on her mind. There were two Venuses here to inflame her heart. The sloping back of Carracci's Venus, the top of two pert buttocks emerging from a fallen robe. Although the satyr exposing his tongue made her feel slightly self-conscious, and she moved away. Miss Everleigh came back to her side to view Titian's Venus of Urbino. She said, "It used to be covered by a sliding panel to conceal her nudity. Such a waste." Evelyn was glad it wasn't now. In the Orientale corridor, they happened across a painting class. "Nothing to see here but childish enthusiasm," said Miss Everleigh, as she waved Evelyn past a Rubens at a brisk pace. They overtook a dawdling group of Americans, murmuring about Caravaggio, and Miss Everleigh whispered pronunciation as she sidled past them. "Ever since Henry James, they think they own the place," she said. And then she led Evelyn into a room, and with a grand flourish said, "Caravaggio," as if she had discovered the artist herself. "What do you feel, Miss Skinner?" Evelyn wondered if there was a right answer. "Horror? Beauty?" she said. "Indeed. And here, look, follow the narrative of light to this scene beyond." "Oh, no. Oh, no," said Miss Everleigh, suddenly interrupted by an American to the far left of her. "What that man's saying is not right at all. Caravaggio came out of mannerism and stepped right back into reformed classicism, full of rage and drama. It was a slap in the face to his peers. See here. Shadows, pain, dark, light. Repeat, Miss Skinner. Shadows, pain, dark, light." "Correct," said Miss Everleigh, and they marched to the next room, the mantra startling a nearby tourist, who looked for the reference in their well-thumbed Baedeker. When weariness and lunch had overtaken them, they took rest by an open window and let their eyes fall uncritically across the city. "Could only be Florence, couldn't it?" said Miss Everleigh. "Burnt umber, ochre, cream, brown-grey shutters, the Arno always green. Such is the palette of Florence." "It's my first time in this city, Miss Everleigh. There's so much to see. And I wonder if I have enough time and..." Miss Everleigh raised her hand. "You will be back, my dear. We all come back. Do you remember your first time?" "Do I indeed? Like Saul falling from his horse and becoming Paul. It changed me. The city spoke to me in a language I didn't understand, and yet in here..." She clasped her chest. "I knew exactly what it was saying to me." "Which was?" Miss Everleigh held up four fingers. She said, "I will astonish you." With the "you," she gently pressed her finger against Evelyn's heart. "Open up. Things happen here, if you let them. Wonderful things, Miss Skinner. When you least expect it. Are you ready, my dear, for things to happen?
Oh, yes, said Evelyn.
I've never been more ready. Cherish the body, and the soul will follow. Did you write that?
Alas, no. The Greeks, probably. Sounds like the Greeks.
Their last port of call was a sculpture room. No one of quality here, said Miss Everley. True, it was an exit room. But it was in this room that Evelyn became overcome. Miss Skinner's voice in the background, maybe Cleopatra, she said, Ariadne, perhaps. It might even be Sappho. Odd arm, though. But Evelyn didn't care about the arm, or who sculpted it, or who the subject was. It was the most beautiful woman, prostrate and naked, and that was all it needed to be. The whoosh of the sea crashed inside her ears, breasts peeking from the folds of marble, the nipples so real, for the sole tantalizing effect of making Evelyn feel alive, awake, vital, and true.
Miss Skinner, you've gone quite pale. Make way, scusate, Americano, please, scusate. Out of the way immediately, if you please. Come, take my arm, Miss Skinner. Follow me. It's this beauty. It's all this beauty. We English are at the mercy of the muse. I took to my bed for days when I first set eyes on the Del Sarto.
And she led Evelyn away to a seat and a restorative glass of water. Neither spoke. The moment was too momentous. That night, Evelyn avoided dinner. Little notes from Miss Everley were slipped under her door, and she enjoyed reading about the Lug's amusing faux pas with the pronunciation of a German count. And then, as she was about to sleep, there was a knock at her door, which she answered, and which brought her face to face with Livia, the maid, a fresh bowl of water in her hands. Livia walked past her and placed the bowl on the dresser. She turned and smiled at Evelyn.
It's your birthday soon, she said.
Broken English with an unexpected Cockney accent.
Yes, said Evelyn. It is.
The night of Evelyn's birthday, and vermouth was the drink du soir.
Vermouth? Imagine!
Miss Everley offered a toast about being 21, all in verse, of course, before she led Evelyn into the dining room, into an exquisite setting of candlelight and scent. Sprigs of rosemary, slightly crushed, were draped over picture frames and woven into the backs of chairs, the small blue heads a perfect complement to the pots of violets running centrally down the table. The aroma was heady and majestic. Evelyn sat down, and Livia came out from the kitchen and smiled. She moved behind Evelyn, flapped out her napkin and placed it on her lap, somewhat slowly and sensuously. She did the same for Miss Everley, but without the added tactile delight. Other guests entered and gasped at their evening of Italian authenticity and bellezza. Reverend Hindsight was overcome and said grace before he sat down, and Mr. Collins bellowed, "Well, this is more like it," and took his position opposite Evelyn. He lifted the bottle of wine and filled the glasses around him. By the time the rabbit, white beans and bitter greens were on the plate, two conversations played out either side of Evelyn, and she found it hard to follow either. To her left, Miss Everley was enjoying a heated disagreement with an American who was studying Henry James, the effect he had on the city of Florence, and the effect the city of Florence had on him. Miss Everley loathed him from the start.
"Oh, no," said Miss Everley. "I totally disagree. The factionalism of the Guelphs and Ghibellines at its heart was a struggle between Pope and Emperor. And in Florence, a permissible interfamilial war for power, totally unnecessary, and led to the exiling of my dear heart Dante. He never got over it, and frankly, neither have I."
And to her right, the Reverend had just asked her a question.
"Miss Skinner," he said, "can you think of one? An element of transformation?"
Evelyn thought for a moment. Livia brushed past, which prompted her neural pathways to spark and caused a momentary flicker of the candles.
Il calore è un elemento di trasformazione, said Evelyn,
looking at Livia, who had begun to clear the table.
Heat is an element of transformation, she said.
Heat? How interesting. You make it sound so positive, said Mr. Lugg. Heat rather transforms me into a heaving blob. Ergo, we travel in the autumn and winter months. I had to turn down a position in India because of the heat.
Not just because of the heat, darling, said Mrs. Lugg.
No, no, no. Not just because of the heat. And they looked eagerly about at their fellow diners, seeking a reflection of their own prejudice and bigotry.
Oh, that's rather lovely, said Miss Everleigh suddenly, ignoring the new guest and joining in the discussion. Simply put, Miss Skinner, you are advocating the need to wear fewer clothes.
I am, said Evelyn. The fewer the better. What might that do to a body? The shifting of weight, the lightness on the soul, you might say, the ease of movement, to rid oneself of an encumbrance. That, to me, is transformational.
We remember the rigid corset, said the Brown sisters. When we stopped wearing them, our spines had no strength, and we toppled over.
Bone turned to aspic, said Mr. Collins. Miss Everleigh said, It is a startling fact how the heat of a European sun encourage us travellers to slough off the English tweed and embrace the linens of fairer climes. Lighter clothes, lighter the impulse, lighter the body, lighter the mind. I also feel a need to wear trousers here, she added.
Good Lord, said the identical twins. Trousers?
Indeed, trousers, Miss and Miss Brown. The sturdy feel of enclosure around the most intimate part of my anatomy would bring great freedom. Evelyn noticed that the other table had stopped slurping soup and were looking over at them. Why the need for trousers, Miss Everleigh? Asked Mr. Lugg.
I have a need to stride out, Mr. Lugg. To walk as a man might walk, with all the benefits. I do not need to be a woman here. I wish to repel the male gaze, to move through the city with the ease of a man. I want to view the city through the eyes of a man. A poet, you see, is a shapeshifter.
A what? Said Blythe Brown.
A selkie, said Miss Everleigh. One moment a seal, one moment a man. I am there to probe the hidden depths of the ocean, the raging tides of emotions, and then to surface in all my humanness, in all my humility, to recount in a handful of lines the myriad of tales I have encountered, the worlds in which I have travelled, the battles fought, like Odysseus.
Didn't she say she was a seal? Said one of the Brown twins.
Not a real seal, said Evelyn.
Then why did she say it?
Luckily, the conversation came to an abrupt end when an overweight gentleman at the next table choked on a piece of rabbit. Mr. Collins was up first. Make way, make way. He stood behind the gentleman, who was now blue, gripped both hands below his breastbone, and forcefully pushed against the diaphragm. The offending meat shot out of his mouth and hit Queen Victoria between the eyes. The dining room became silent, morbidly so. Evelyn wondered if her birthday would end there. Miranda Lugg, misreading the incident as she so often did, said quite loudly to the gentleman, You disgust me. It was fair to say the near fatality took the edge off what had been, up till then, a very jolly evening. But in the small fissure that had opened up, the Brown sisters took their chance and suggested a musical interlude. They offered to play a duet they'd written together when the first Opium War was in its ascendancy.
Cheery, said Mr. Collins.
I have known the Brown twins for many years, Mr. Collins, and I can confidently say that there is no finer duet playing, said the Reverend. We are incredibly fortunate. Miss Everleigh? After you. Miss Everleigh groaned and downed a full glass of wine. Evelyn waited for the dining room to clear. Are you not coming, Miss Skinner? Said Mr. Collins.
In a minute, Mr. Collins. I
say no more, Miss Skinner. And he smiled that smile he'd recently adopted around her and left the room.
Evelyn stood awkwardly by the table. A bit hot, a bit tipsy. A sprig of rosemary coiled around her fingers. She had just decided to go into the kitchen and present herself when Livia exited. They stood unmoving, gazing into each other's eyes, a lustful note undeniably felt. Evelyn hesitated. She began. Io, she began again in Italian. I've never been given such a gift. Thank you, Livia. Oh, how good it felt to say her name. For all this, which I will never forget, which I will talk about till I'm old and decrepit. Livia laughed. I will, you know. Remember it forever, said Evelyn. Because when I like something, I like it very much and never want to let it go. I don't want this to end, she said, and she stepped closer. Closer still. Livia laughed. Livia said, nothing has to end. And she leant over the table and picked a violet and handed it to Evelyn. For you, she said. Evelyn rushed into the drawing room and saw that a space had been left between Mr. Collins and Miss Everly. You look radiant, said Miss Everly. Just a little hot, said Evelyn. But heat is an element of transformation, is it not? Said Mr. Collins, raising both eyebrows. Midnight. Evelyn, 21 and 1 minute old. Lights from a tram flickered briefly in her bedroom. She unwrapped her handkerchief and there, in the middle of the white linen square, was the violet flower. She opened her Baedeker and pressed it between the pages. She bent down and kissed it. Little did she know that 2 days was all it would take for that kiss to progress from Baedeker to lips. It was the afternoon. Evelyn in her room, sluggish from lunch, drawn to the window by the sound of a violin. And there was Livia out walking. Evelyn ran down the stairs, bonnet loose, buttons undone, hair askew. Can't stop, Miss Everly. Fly free, my sweet thing. Out into the street now, running alongside the Arno, hands holding up her skirt, weaving around handcarts and laundry boys and working girls and dogs and priests and nuns and washerwomen and tourists, and all the while calling out her name. Livia stopped, turned, and smiled. They walked the river east and left behind the sand diggers until they found a good enough place of solitude. They clambered down onto the foreshore in the shadow of a bridge and shyly faced one another. Hands touched cheeks and fingers lips, and there they kissed, because the eyes of the city were not on them. It was their first kiss. Evelyn held her bonnet as the breeze tried to lift it. Bells were faint, pronouncing the hour. But which hour? Time had ceased. Somewhere in the air, the quiet cast of a lure whipped the water and sent ripples to their feet. In the time it took for them to return to the pensione, the most extraordinary shift had taken place within those tired, judgmental walls, that of love preceding them. It had crept ahead, scattering benevolence and joy. The heavy mahogany furniture acquired an Italian flair, and the Cockney Signora's H's, as rare as a Marian apparition, made an unexpected appearance. Stew had been taken off the evening menu once again, and even Reverend Hindsight practiced compassion by including Mr. Collins in an upcoming visit to the opera. And Miss Everly? Simply put, she wrote her best poem in years. The weather, too, was affected by the tenderness of that sweet embrace. The sun was re-energized, and the warmth of its long arm encroached upon autumn's flimsy grasp. Stars shone brighter, and even a full moon declared itself a honey. Love was resplendent that day, and when the light was angled right across Piazza Santa Croce, one could almost believe that Dante smiled when he heard a young woman called Evelyn whisper to one called Livia, "You are my teacher and my author." The rapid progression from kissing to something more happened the night the Reverend arranged a visit to the Teatro Verdi to watch a production of Spontini's La Vestale. "I've heard it's as good as Covent Garden," he declared at breakfast one morning. Evelyn knew the outing would fall on Livia's night off, so both women agreed that Evelyn would leave at the end of the second act, and Livia would be waiting somewhere nearby, in the dark. The subterfuge was dramatic enough. Who needed opera? The orchestra tuned up, and Evelyn sidled along the third-tier row towards Miss Everly's enthusiastic waving. Mr. Collins hadn't arrived yet either, and his empty seat inflamed the Reverend's ire. He was seated in the first tier, along with the Lugs and the Browns, and an American couple he'd saved in San Lorenzo after they'd been cornered by a pack of feral cats. The audience was quite boisterous, and not like Covent Garden at all. And here came Mr. Collins, all flustered and surprisingly handsome. "Sorry, sorry, sorry," he said as he made his way to his seat.
"You're late," said Reverend Hindsight.
The sharpness of the last consonant was the cue for the gaslights to dim, and the overture began. Miss Everly clasped Evelyn's hand, and the women succumbed to the music. After the first act, Evelyn and Miss Everly followed the crowds to the cafe and accepted a glass of champagne from a portly German who spoke good English. Miss Everly thought the soprano was jolly good, and Evelyn agreed. And then Evelyn leant in close to her ear and said, "I'm going to feign a headache and leave at the end of Act Two, Miss Everly."
"How marvellous," said Miss Everly. "A romantic assignation?"
Evelyn smiled.
"Leave it to me," said Miss Everly. "I shall take care of this."
So when Act Two came to an end and Evelyn got up to leave, Miss Everly could be heard saying,
"She has an awful headache, a right old thumper. We might not see her for days, Reverend."
The night air was fresh, and Evelyn, head down, pushed through the waiting cabmen and their lascivious comments and raced towards her rendezvous. She hadn't got very far before the rendezvous came to her and pulled her into a dark alleyway. A warm mouth on hers, a broad wall at her back. Footsteps somewhere pressed them further into the shadows. A dog barked, a man singing from an upstairs window. Warm breath on her neck, in her ear. The recklessness of the situation made her brave. She slid her hand into Livia's blouse and onto her breast. Livia clasped the hem of Evelyn's skirt and drew it up. Livia's hand slipped into her drawers, and soon Evelyn felt the smooth glide of fingers inside her. The sound of a horse and cart going past. And then, only the sensation of pleasure, as her mouth was smothered by a hand and her body turned liquid. Undeterred by the church, class, and convention, sex between the young lovers favourably won out. They decided they'd need a protective cloak under which to hide their love, and they found one sharpish and called it Italian lessons. Whatever afternoon or morning Livia had free became the framework for this study. Beyond that, brushed shoulders and looks of longing were the flint spark to this tentative bed of passion. Evelyn became quite the linguist.
"Isn't she a delicious little thing?"
said Miss Everly, as Livia passed by one morning with an armful of linen. Evelyn blushed. An hour before, they'd just fingered one another in the closet.
"She's a jolly good teacher," said Evelyn. "She's already got me on the modals. Could and should. And let's not forget would," said Miss Everly.
Between silent kisses, verb declension could often be heard coming from Evelyn's room. Sometimes the Cockney Signora would stop to listen, recalling her own intrepid years of learning. The Reverend passed by her door full of admiration at Miss Skinner's enthusiasm and diligence. And Mr. Collins? All he could do was shake his head and smile, as if he was party to a private joke he had no intention of sharing. Back in the room, Evelyn's notebook had been cast aside next to blouses and stockings and undergarments. The young women facing one another on the bed, topless, kissing. A light breeze through the shutters, texturing their skin. All the while, Evelyn remembering to say out loud,
"The omnibus is due at 10. The omnibus was due at 10. The omnibus had been due at 10.
A few days later, Evelyn bought postcards at Alinari's, intending to return to the pensione to write them. However, the morning suddenly shed its dull cloak, revealing an ensemble of bright wonder, and instantly energized She took off into the city, which was becoming more and more familiar every day. She would stop to smell an orange, or a bunch of basil, or to converse with whoever manned the till. In Piazza della Signoria, tourists had gathered at an outside bar, and she immediately decided to do the same. A quick tour of the statuary, and then back to a table to write her postcards. A horse and cart passed in front of her, and she was careful not to follow too close behind. The light was beautiful, faint shadows whispering. Sunlight caught the trefoils above, fortitude, temperance, justice and prudence, the four cardinal virtues. A breeze followed her into the Loggia dei Lanzi like a spectral presence, and led her to Giovanni da Bologna's Rape of the Sabine Woman. The statue startled her, bewitched her, coaxed from her equal feelings of shame and exhilaration. Her gaze rested on the foot, the curve, the rounded heel, the hand pressing onto the woman's buttocks, the flesh yielding. But it wasn't flesh, was it? It was marble. She took out her notebook and drew a simple sketch. No shading needed, just lines that traced the liquidity of movement, mapping the erotic to the horror, this execution of genius. She was shown to a table where she ordered a quina vermouth. She felt great freedom sitting outside. She rolled up the sleeves of her blouse, her skin olive like her mother's. She was about to begin a postcard to her father, but thought it better to practice in her notebook first, before committing words to the back of the Duomo. She looked across once again to the statue of the Sabine woman. "Miss Skinner?" Evelyn turned. The flare of sun caught her eyes. She raised her hand.
"Oh, Mr. Collins.
May I?"
"Please do."
Mr. Collins sat and gestured to the waiter for the same drink as Evelyn. "I've just been to the Uffizi with Miss Everly. She's quite the guide. I'll never look at a pomegranate in the same way again." Evelyn laughed. "She said you came over faint in one of the sculpture rooms." "Has she told everyone?"
"No, just me," said Mr. Collins.
"Grazie, signore," said Mr. Collins as his drink was placed in front of him.
"Was Miss Everly worried?" said Evelyn.
"Not at all. I think she thought something quite marvellous had happened to you."
"Like what?"
"She didn't say. You know how she is. She gets that look upon her face as if, oh, you know, as if a secret has been unearthed," said Mr. Collins, and he looked at her intently. "Has something happened to you, Miss Skinner?"
"I'm not sure," she said.
"Good Lord. It's not love, is it?"
"Of course not," said Evelyn crossly.
Crossly enough for Mr. Collins to reach for his drink, smile, and to change the subject. "A toast," he said. They raised their glasses. "Incipit vita nuova," he said.
"So begins a new life," said Evelyn. Clink.